Hey, this is John. Today's episode is one from the vault. Back in episode 433, I sat down with Greta Gerwig to talk about her film Little Women. This is one of those only on Script Notes kind of interviews where we go through pages of the script and really look at the choices she made during writing, why she made those choices, how they manifested on the screen, and even get into sort of the specifics of how you hide stuff from the studio in the writing process so you can actually get what you need while you're directing. It gets really specific. And man, I just loved Greta Gerwig. You can tell I have a total talent crush on her throughout this interview. Greta Gerwig, of course, after this went on to make Barbie, which is one of the biggest movies of the summer. We cannot wait to get her back on the show to talk with her about that project. But in the meantime, listen to this episode because you'll really get a sense of what a talented filmmaker she is and how that talent first manifests on the page. So enjoy this episode. We should be back next week with a brand new one. Thanks. Enjoy. Hello and welcome. My name is John August.
Hello, I'm Greta Gerwig.
And this is episode 433 of Script Notes.
Wow.
A podcast about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. 433 episodes. Today on this show, we'll be discussing ambition, authorship, and adaptation, which is why we're so lucky to have Greta Gerwig filling in for Craig. She is the acclaimed writer and director of Little Women and Lady Bird. We're going to answer some listener questions about descriptive writing and parenthood as well.
Great.
Craig is out sick today, but he has promised to join me after the credits for a bonus segment for premium members where we talk about what was happening with him and Tiffany Haddish at the Golden Globes. So Craig won a Golden Globe. He won a Golden Globe for Chernobyl.
That's amazing.
Which is great. And now you already had a Golden Globe because you won a Golden Globe for Lady Bird.
Actually, you know what the thing is? Because I wasn't listed as a producer on Lady Bird or on Little Women, I actually don't have any awards.
Well, you have many awards. You don't have a Golden Globe?
No, because it won a Golden Globe for Best Comedy, but because I'm not a producer, I don't have a Golden Globe.
I'm going to throw this table.
I know.
I'm so angry.
I know. People are like, let me see your Golden Globe. And I'm like, the thing is, I don't have one. It's quite all right. I think eventually I will be a producer on my projects. But for the first couple, I was like, I want other people to be able to take that full space.
That's fair. So I assume that you and Craig had that in common at winning Golden Globes. But you and I have something in common I discovered during our research. Mm. We are both born on August 4th.
No.
We are birthday twins.
Birthday twins plus Obama.
Plus Obama. The three of us a powerful team.
And I think Queen Elizabeth. Is that right?
That sounds right. I'll believe it.
Yeah. No.
Say it with confidence and we'll believe it.
Queen Elizabeth. No, that's really great. Leo.
Yeah. Well, Leo. Yeah. And I don't really believe in astrology, but like...
Oh, I do.
But I have many qualities of that Leo.
I mean, I don't know that I believe in it in that, like, I don't know that I think there's a correlation between the facts of the world and what you can glean from astrology. Mm-hmm. However, I think people use lots of things, which it's not technically based in hard fact at all. And if it makes you a little happier, why not? I mean, an astrologist told me once that I was in a lucky corridor. It was when I was making Lady Bird, actually. And then she was like, so if anything goes wrong, just ask yourself, how is this an opportunity for me? Because it is. And I was like, well, that's just pretty good advice.
Yeah, exactly.
In general.
Yeah. So astrology, maybe not true, but good advice, always
good
advice, welcome.
Good advice. And I have Leo-ish qualities.
Well, I'm going to be asking a lot of advice from you for our listeners. But let me lay out the overall agenda of things I'd love to talk about while I have you here for this hour. So great. I want to talk about your adaptation of Little Women, which is unconventional and just terrific.
Thank you.
We have the script in front of us, so we'll be able to do some deep diving on some scenes. But I want to know how you came to write it, why you wrote it.
Yes.
This is a story about ambition. Joe is very ambitious. You are ambitious as a filmmaker. You were instrumental in helping create a whole genre of filmmaking. So we should talk about that. Mm-hmm. And then I want to talk about the notion of authorship, because Joe aspires so hard to be an author. And the work I associate you with is so autobiographical. And so like Little Women is sort of meta autobiographical because of some of the things you did, but you know, Lady Bird is highly autobiographical. So like the degree to which you are writing things that only you could write is, I think, a good thing for us to talk about. So
great.
That'll be our agenda for this hour. But I want to know how you came to write Little Women, because it's a public domain story. You could have written it at any time, but you wrote it in a very specific way. So tell me about how you came to write it.
Well, the truth is actually I didn't really know about the public domain, not public domain, for a long time in terms of the text of Little Women. But I grew up reading this book. I read it many, many times. And Joe March was my favorite character. And in many ways, she was the character that made me believe I could be a writer, because she wanted to be a writer. She was a writer. And then in some way that I didn't know completely, but I think you intuit when you're reading it, is because you're holding the book Little Women, mm-hmm. in some ways, you know, she became the writer who wrote the book, even though it's a different name.
Yeah.
And I didn't really know who Louisa May Alcott was, because I read books the way all kids read books, which is that the things within their pages seem real to you, even though they're fiction. And I think at the last time I'd read the book, I was something like 14 or 15. And then when I was 30, I reread it and I felt like I'd never read it before. I felt like it was brand new.
You read it just out of lark? There was no reason?
And I was actually moving out of one apartment into another apartment. And that's often the occasion to uncover some things, which is why it's sometimes good to either move or clean stuff out, because then you revisit stuff. And anyway, I had the copy of Little Women that I had when I was a girl, and I reread it, or I sat down to sort of like page through it. And then I started reading it and I was like, oh my God, this is, in one way, I almost know this by heart. And in another way, I feel like I've never read it. I feel like it's totally modern and strange and pressing. And I knew I wanted to make it into a film. I started seeing it as a film. And then coincidentally, my agent mentioned that Amy Pascal and the folks over at Sony were interested in making it. And I said, you got to get me in that room. And I went and I talked to Amy and Denise DeNovi and Robin Swycourt, and I told them what I wanted to do with it. And I hadn't yet directed Lady Bird, so it was a long shot. But they said, initially what they said yes to was me writing the screenplay.
Now, let's talk about you as a writer before that moment, because you'd written on other movies before and you directed before, but much smaller things.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what were they reading of your work? Because
why did they give me this job?
Yeah. I'm just really curious. No. Like, you coming into this room, like what was it like?
Well, I had co-written two screenplays with Noah, Frances Ha and Mistress America. I think especially now that I've written and directed stuff on my own, I think it's a little easier to see how much of that is my writing. Yeah. But I think when you're initially a co-writer, and also when you're an actor, I think there's almost an assumption that maybe you just wrote the lines you said,
exactly,
which is not true, but it's an understandable assumption. And then,
and that's probably true for any writing team in general. Like, you don't know whether one of them by themselves can really do the work.
Exactly. And you're not sure. And because Noah had done things alone, it's a little harder to tease out. But I'd done that. But then I had been hired properly. I mean, by a person. I wrote a script for Lionsgate for Eric Feig. And I knew they had an idea of doing something. I pitched and I said, here's what, and they gave me the job and I wrote them a script. And it was, and so that was kind of the first thing that I'd done like that. And then actually, interestingly, on a sitcom that I tried to do that didn't work, How I Met Your Father, How I Met Your Dad, I was a writer on that as well. So
there are things people could look at, say like, oh, she can really write by herself.
Yeah, there were a couple of things, but it was kind of on faith. I mean, I did give them the script to Lady Bird, even though I hadn't made Lady Bird yet, and said, well, I wrote this, but...
Well, okay. That's a pretty good script. So, I mean,
it was a good script, but I also think, you know, it's hard to be the first one in the pool, you know? And I thought it was a good script, and I had gotten some feedback that people said, oh yes, it's a good script, but like nobody really knows yet. You know, you have to believe in the thing before anybody else says it's good. And that's like, you know, what makes great, you know, producers, is that they can read something without anybody else telling them it's good and think it's good. I had that script, but it was still kind of, they certainly didn't hire me to direct it. And it was like, well, give it a shot.
Yeah.
It wasn't like,
take a chance on you.
Yeah. It wasn't like some big, like now we're all in on you. And I think because I always wanted to direct it and thought that I should, but even though they weren't thinking that way, I think a couple of things help in that regard, which is that I sort of had a sense of like, I'm going to do whatever I want with this script because I mean, nobody's ever going to make this.
Well, let's talk about going into that room, meeting with, because I know Amy well, and I know Denise, and I know Robin Swycourt. Mm-hmm. They're all very smart, accomplished women.
Yes.
What was your conversation? Were you coming into them saying like, I want to do Little Women, and here is my take of a nonlinear way to get into this and how you're going to handle all this? How much of it did you know as you were going into those meetings?
I knew quite a bit actually going into the meetings. Well, I think one of the first things I said was that I said, to me, this book is about authorship and ownership, and it's about money, and it's about women and money, and how that intersects with artistic output. And it felt like it was all over the book to me. And then I had already started looking at Louisa May Alcott's life and what that was, and how that intersected with the subject of the book. And I didn't quite know how I was going to interweave the time periods, but I did know I wanted to start with them as adults. That was the way I wanted to come at it. And I think in part because I knew that the adaptation I wanted to do was not just an adaptation of the text as it is in the book, although I did rely heavily on the text in the book. I also wanted to treat all adaptations as almost an text, as a collective memory of what Little Women is, so that there are things, you know, this is an example that I don't know how much it's useful, but I always think about it. Our conceptions of heaven and hell, for example, they're not from the Bible.
No, they're
from Dante. Like that's where we got all of it from. So like, if you actually go to the Bible and you're like, where are the descriptions of the hellfires? They're not there. They don't exist, because that's something we got later. And I do think that there's this sense of an text, or a collective text, which it means more than even what the original text said. So I felt like I had the original text, but then I had images. And the images are things like Marmee and the girls gathered around the fire reading the letter from Father, and the kiss in the rain under the umbrella, and Amy falling in the ice or burning the book, or like there are these little moments, or going to the Hummels or the Christmas morning. There's these moments that I feel like they're from the book, but they're also from all of the times we've seen it.
The collective unconscious, it's what we associate as you know, this being. Yeah.
Exactly. So what I wanted to do was kind of find a way for that to be almost like the found materials, and then to explode it and deconstruct it and put it back together again.
So you mentioned the starting with them as older and then going back to them as children. My guess when I watched the movie was that part of your instinct for doing that was so that the actors that you cast would be established as the older version, so that when you come back to them as the younger version, it didn't feel like a weird mismatch. Like if you'd started with those older actresses as the younger versions, you're like, wait, she's not 13, but you're more forgiving. That's something as a filmmaker you're doing, but it was also you sure your narrative sense of that you really wanted to make sure that the older life of them was as important as the younger version. Like, what was your instinct?
Well, one thing that I realized, there's so many angles I could come at this from, which leads to very long-winded answers. But there's an inherent meta quality to the text, which I was alluding to before, which is that you're holding a book. So someone wrote it. And then so you have like Louisa May Alcott writing Joe, and Louisa May Alcott is writing something that looks vaguely like her life, and Joe is kind of an avatar. And then Joe is also writing something that vaguely looks like her life. And then it's me writing Louisa writing Joe. And it felt like the only way to represent all of this is to get quite cubist about it. It's like there's all these different points of authorship. And I think that there's a real ache in the text. And there's actually a couple lines I could point to that have it. But one thing is that, you know, the text is not it's not first person. It's not Joe narrating it. It's Louisa or the narrator or whoever that person is. And there's a lot of sadness in that person behind the people. And this perspective of, you know, Louisa's real sister is already gone.
Yeah.
She, her sister Elizabeth died, and Louisa herself had gone to the Civil War as a Civil War nurse and had suffered through typhoid fever and almost died. And her sister, not Meg, but the character Meg is based on, she'd gotten she'd gotten married and it was devastating for her. And so there's all these things of like, she is writing about a thing that already passed. And there was something when I was reading the text, and this is why these are every answer is so long-winded. I realized that once they're all in their separate lives, like once Amy's in Europe, once Meg is married, once Beth is living at home, but sick, and Joe's in New York trying to sell stories, they are never all together again. Yeah. The thing that we think of as Little Women has already passed. And I think that ache and that absence of the togetherness and that absence of the sisterhood as being the way that we contextualize these cozy scenes brought out something in me that I felt was inherent in the text. And then I think, you know, I wanted to start it just squarely with the publisher with this idea of this negotiation of, will you buy my work and what do I have to change for you to buy it? And I think, you know, there's another level on which, like, this scene is something that I know from this scene.
Yeah.
I know what it's like to sit in across from someone who basically tells you morals would don't sell nowadays. So it was, I mean, there were lots of reasons for it, but emotionally I felt like there was, yeah, that ache that it's already gone. And then I, beyond that, you know, this relationship of Louisa to the text and me to the text of, I think that what artists do is you write it down because you can't save anyone's life. Like, I think that's part of what the impulse is. I can't save your life, but I can write it down. And I can't get that moment back, but I can write it down. And I think that's part of it for me. And that kind of, and it allowed me to kind of weave that sense of, is that how you remembered it? Or is that what happened? Or is that what happened? Or is that how you wrote it?
Well, you also, by moving back and forth between the two timelines, you're creating a tension for the viewer saying, like, wait, how do we get there? Because I assume that Lori would be with her, but like Lori's with this other guy. And so it becomes a mystery.
Exactly. And then also I will say, this is a less like poetic response, but I think that there's always been, just when you tell the stories narratively straight, this is now just a nuts and boltsy thing. I think there's two things that are tricky about the traditional straight ahead narrative of Little Women. The first one is, Beth gets sick and then she gets better, and then Beth gets sick and then she dies. And I always find that's like a little hard narratively to kind of get, like, oh no, oh, it's okay. Oh no, it's not. Like, yeah. One idea I had was just that stacking. And then there are poetic reasons within the stacking of
there's scenes where, like, yes, you know, she comes down and sees her there, sees her not there. Yeah.
And that feeling of, like, when someone dies, I think you have this inherent feeling of, like, but they were just there, mm-hmm, and it was just the other way. And I felt like it was a way to cinematically give us that. And then the other thing was, I felt as a viewer and as a reader, and why I wanted, I hope there's no spoilers, but why I wanted Mr. Dashwood as the publisher to say, like, frankly, I don't see why she didn't marry the neighbor, is because that's what everyone for 150 years has thought. Like, if you're going to marry someone, you might have well have just married that guy across the street. Like, he seemed really nice and he likes you. And what's wrong with him is that I feel like it's more true in movies than any other medium, that the person you see them with first is the person you believe they should be with. I don't know why it works like that. I just think it tends to work like that. And so one thing when you tell the story straight through is that, you know, you see Lori and Joe together. And when it's like Lori and Amy, you're like, what the hell is this? I've been with these other people. The second thing is, then when you meet Professor Bear, you're like, and who's this guy? Like, I don't know this guy. I don't care about this guy. I've never met this guy.
I don't want him in my movie.
I know. He's an old German professor. Like, who cares? So in a way, I mean, that's just nuts and bolts-y. I was like, if I see Amy run into Lori first, and obviously he's the object of her affection, and if I see Professor Bear at the beginning, then I'm less introducing a new person later. And then on top of it, someone said later, they were like, oh, Professor Bear, when he shows up, it's like Deus Ex Machina, but to me, I was like, but that is what it is. It's in the book. It is Deus Ex Machina. He just shows up. Yeah. And it's like, if we could set that early at the beginning and be like, and I mean, also because I'm dealing with what is storytelling and what do you need and what do you expect from your characters? Like with just the briefest outline of this is a romantic interest that you're like, oh yes, I see it is a romantic interest. Like part of it is playing with narrative expectations. So in any case, that's like the less beautiful answer.
Well, but even in it's trying to establish that as, you know, Baird is a potential love interest, you're doing a very deliberate rhyme where like she's burned her dress both times with both of these guys. And so we associate like, oh, her burning her dress or being caught on fire is a thing that happens when there's a love interest.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, it's right. And also the first scene of the movie when she's trying to tell this scandal story and he says, you know, if the main character is a girl, make sure she ends up married or dead either way. And then the very first scene you see her in, it's like, well, that's there you go. There's the guy. I mean, we just set up guys because it's like he just told her married or dead. So now we have to see, is it married or dead? It's like putting a gun on the wall in the first act.
Yeah. Chekhov's marriage.
Exactly.
All right. Let's take a listen to a scene. So this is a scene from page 68 in the script. This is Amy and Laurie in France. It happens, I think it's chapter 39 of the book. It's pretty late in the book. Yeah. This is a scene between Amy and Laurie. Let's take a listen and then discuss the scene.
I've always known I would marry Rich. Why should I be ashamed of that?
It's nothing to be ashamed of, as long as you love him.
Well, I believe we have some power over who we love. It isn't something that just happens to a person.
I think the poets might disagree.
Well, I'm not a poet. I'm just a woman. And as a woman, there's no way for me to make my own money. Not enough to earn a living or to support my family. And if I had my own money, which I don't, that money would belong to my husband the moment we got married. And if we had children, they would be his, not mine. They would be his property. So don't sit there and tell me that marriage isn't an economic proposition, because it is. It may not be for you, but it most certainly is for me.
Oh, such a great speech.
Thank you.
So Julia Turner, who hosts the Slate Culture Gabfest, they were talking about your amazing movie on this week's episode. And I asked her, like, Greta's coming in, so do you have any more questions for her? And she said, did you always find Amy sympathetic, or is that something that came to you on later readings? Mm. How did your view of her evolve? Because this is the evolved Amy we're hearing in this scene.
Yes. Amy was one of the characters that I was just utterly knocked backwards by when I read it again. And she was the one that I kept underlining lines. And there were so many great lines, I couldn't even get them all in. I mean, everything about this script, I will say, can be essentially footnoted. I could tell you why every line is there. And it's either directly from the book or it's from a piece of research but she has a line where she says, I don't pretend to be wise, but I am observant. And I was like, holy crap, like, who's this? Like, that's such an amazing sentiment. And I felt like all of a sudden, oh, she's been sitting here this whole time. And I felt, to me, actually, the section when she's in Paris and in Italy, but when she's with Laurie and she's kind of contending with her art, I found that to be very profound. And it was, you know, that the line, I want to be great or nothing, was something that's, it's straight from the book. And I was like, well, that's not a person who takes their art lightly. That's somebody who's really swinging for the fences. And I think that depth of seriousness about her work was fascinating to me. And also the pain of giving it up because she doesn't think it's going to go great is, that's a very adult thing, and it's something that I very much understand. And so, yeah, Amy was the one who was fascinating to me and also hilarious in a way that I felt like I hadn't even totally tapped into, which was, I hadn't realized when I was younger, but there's a whole section. I mean, there's so many great things in the book that I couldn't include, but there's a whole section where she says, she's asking about Beth because Beth is very good at, you know, piano. And I think it's after Mr. Lawrence gives her the piano and Amy is trying to logically work out what the difference between her and Beth is. And she's like, oh, I see. It's nice to have talents, but it's not nice to tell everyone you have them. And they're like, right. And then and it just like, but she's not humble, but she's figuring out yeah. that to be liked, she better look like she's humble, which I think is really funny and really great. And anyway, she just was so much richer and funnier than I had ever, I'd ever really totally given her credit for. And I, in any case, and like the line, I don't pretend to be wise, but I am observant. I later turned that into the line where she says, you know, since when did you become so wise? And she says, I always have been. You were just too busy noticing my faults. I kind of thought that for me, it's like for 150 years, we've looked at this character as being kind of petty and a little shallow. And I was like, we never noticed. She was always kind of amazing.
Let's take a look at the scene again. Sure. So this is a moment where Lori is really noticing how incredible she is. Right. So she says, I've always known I would marry Rich. Why should I be ashamed of that, Lori? There's nothing to be ashamed of as long as you love him. He's the person challenging, like, but, you know,
right.
the romantic ideal that you should marry for love. And she
right.
has the insight to say, like, no, this is an economic yes. transaction.
Yeah.
This was obviously a thing you pitched from the very start, yes. this idea that this is really a story of money.
Right.
And here it is. So what of this, of her speech here, what comes from the text? Because sure. we looked through chapter 39 and couldn't find any of those words, but the spirit is there. It's a
the
much
spirit
longer,
is there.
A much longer scene, a much longer yeah. conversation, but none of these actual words. So how do you get to this?
Well, okay. So the line, I've always known I would marry Rich. That's from the text. She does say that. And later she feels sort of embarrassed about actually having said that. But this speech, actually, for the most part, it comes from a conversation I had with, Meryl Streep about this movie, which we had an early coffee and we talked about it and she was going to be in it and the book had meant a great deal to her. And then she essentially said to me, the thing that you have to make the audience understand is this. And she said some version of this, but she was sort of like, it's not just that women couldn't vote. It's not just that they couldn't own property. They couldn't. It's that they didn't own anything and that they legally couldn't unless they were, you know, completely unmarried and had their own fortune. But even then it was complicated. They couldn't get educated. And so she was sort of laying out these limitations. And I knew I wanted Amy to have a speech like this, but actually this particular speech I wrote 10 minutes before we shot.
Holy cow.
Yeah, because I knew I wanted it to get there and I knew I wanted them to have this conversation. But and this is just, I mean, I assume the people who are listening are screenwriters. In the run up to making the movie, what often happens is, you know, you end up having to cut a lot of stuff to make page count seem lower because you're trying to be like, this isn't unwieldy. This is completely reasonable mm-hmm. to make. So you end up like cutting so much stuff. And I, what I was doing, and it doesn't matter now because it's all made, but what I did was I cut the script down, but then I would just save the pages I wanted to make. And then right before we go, I just give them to the actors and I'd say, all right, we're going to do this. Or I'd give them the night before or something. Or sometimes I'd just give it to them handwritten. So there was no paper trail because I didn't want them to give it to anyone. And I'd say like, can you just say these things? Because I figured like once the lines are in the dailies, what are they going to do? No, tell me I can't have them?
They're not going to compare back to the printed pages. No,
nobody's going to do that. And like, so I knew I wanted something like this, but I knew like, nobody's going to let me do this.
So there wasn't, so the scene existed in the shooting script, but yes. it was shorter and it didn't have quite this text in it.
I think the scene ended with, the saying ended before the speech.
Wow.
It ended before the speech because nobody was interested in the speech. And anyway, I hand wrote it. I gave it to her. And, but I always knew I wanted something like that in it. But I just felt like hearing Amy say, I want to marry Rich sounds quite crass if you don't really understand the mm-hmm. stakes of what that means. Yeah. And it's, you know, for women at that time, it was the decision. And if you married the wrong person, if you married someone
disastrous.
Who had a drinking problem or couldn't make a living or treated your children badly, that's it. That's the worst decision you could make. So in any case, I wanted to give her, context.
Yeah. Now, while we're looking at physical printed pages here, two things you do in the script, which I find so great and so fascinating. So first off, all the scenes that are in the past you have printed in red. And was that from the very start? Did you always plan to do that?
Yes, I always plan. I always did it that way.
Yeah, because very few scripts have such a back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And it's got to be so helpful for everybody involved to know, like, okay, from production design to costumes to everyone, like, what world are we in?
It was a beast in prep, though, I will say, just tracking everything. And we had things set out that, you know, on boards where it was like, here it is chronologically. And then here it is the way it appears in the script, because I just always wanted the present and the past to be talking to each other.
Of course.
And there's always a link. And in some ways, like, I felt like I wanted everything to work emotionally, that, you know, we're moving from one place to another, that even if you're not intimately familiar with the story, because the truth is everything moves forward, which is there's two origin points of the story, 1868 and 1861, and everything moves forward from there. You don't actually go back in this story. You just go between those two timelines that are everything's going forward. But I wanted it. Yeah. So I wanted it to work emotionally, but I also wanted it to, if you broke it down to, you know, completely work logically. I actually did look at him like a graph, like Nolan had made during Dunkirk, because he had the three timelines that took different amount of time, different amounts of time. And I really loved that intersection of time and the play with it. But you might not know on first viewing how everything lines up. You just are are watching it emotionally.
But you also have confidence that it will work.
Right. So if you do break it down later, it all works. And so I wanted it to be, you know, have that thing that it both worked. I mean, there's lots of movies that do that. Irishman does it.
Big Fish does it the same way. So
yes,
Big Fish,
that's right.
So we both timelines move forward, but we're in a fantasy timeline or a real world timeline. And ultimately they overlap. So
I mean, I think it is one of the things, it's tricky to do and it's scary to do, but I think it's something that movies do well. Yeah. It can play with time in a way that other mediums can't as much. Like, it's certainly harder in theater.
Yeah.
And it's also because this is it's a movie about what it is to make something and to make something of your life.
Absolutely.
So it felt like the exact right way to play with it. But yeah, I put it in red from the beginning. And, I remember Tom Rossman, who's, Columbia Pictures, who's great. I always say he's my favorite person to fight with. he was like, but I know that it's the other time because it's red. How will anyone else know? And I was like, don't worry, we'll figure it out.
There'll be a flashing red light in the corner that says, past.
I know. But it was actually in the writing of it, it was always like this. And then, but it was a bit of a trick in the beginning to figure out how to kind of present everything. But I really have faith in viewers because, you know, I love lots of complicated movies, but also people watch really complicated television shows with multiple plot lines, multiple timelines. And I was like, viewers are super sophisticated. Like, I think that they're very good at, I mean, I watch Game of Thrones. It's amazing how intricate it is. Like, I think that sometimes people underestimate how sophisticated viewers are, and they really are able to follow things that aren't, you don't need to signpost everything as strongly as you think you need to sometimes. And actually, I mean, it's so funny because I don't know if you've ever had this experience, like while you're making something, you encounter different things and then you're like, oh, well, they did it this way and they did it this way. But also at Columbia Pictures was Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I loved very much. But like, I remember talking to Tom about it. And then sometimes there's a Chiron that says like, oh, it's, you know, this place or this time. And then sometimes there's not. And
and
I was like, how does he do that? And Tom, I think, was like, because sometimes the audience needs it and sometimes they don't. And I was like, oh, that's right. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Like, but I think sometimes when you're conceiving of these things, everything feels like it has to be so very logical. And the truth is, when you're watching a movie, sometimes you need it, sometimes you don't.
I will say, in watching your film, at the start, I wasn't quite clear what timeline we were in for a while. And I gave up worrying about it. And I just trusted that it was going to work, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
But I was reading our local, like, you know, free paper that gets distributed, the Hancock Park, whatever. The reviewer gave your movie a 9 out of 10 and said, phenomenal, except that it has this crazy nonlinear thing, which is completely unnecessary.
And it's really funny.
You don't understand the movie you watched, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, you know, what's funny is like, you might not think it was necessary, but maybe you wouldn't have had the experience you had told it linearly. I mean, that's the thing. I don't know. Movies are mysterious like that.
Will do a cut of Little Women where it puts everything back in order.
Well, it can't be done. It really can't be done because it's not made that way. No. Like it's not constructed that way. There is no entry point. And I will say there was in the edit a moment where we looked at, because we were asked to look at, could you do it the other way? And you can't. I mean, there's no movie. And actually one thing that's not funny, but it's just, I've noticed is like, again, I hope it's not like spoilery, but like, I assume if you're listening to this, like you've seen it. One thing when shows or whatever have asked for clips, one thing that's interesting to me is I often find that the clips aren't very good at communicating what it is, because if you see just childhood in isolation,
it looks weird.
Looks weird because that's actually not what it is. And if you see, it's like seeing the kiss at the end of the movie as if it was just the kiss, like, but that's not what it is. So like when you just see them gathered around reading the letter from father, it looks like a very like pitch straight down the middle, but it's not a pitch down the middle. It's like what's the pitch that drops? Do you know baseball?
No.
God.
I always talk about sports ball on this show, and Craig always makes fun of me for not knowing that. Like a slider, a drop?
Yeah, slider.
Or something.
So it's a slider or something.
We'll pretend.
Like it looks like it's coming over the plate, and then it's just not. So I find that, like, actually, there's no way to really. The tone is the contrast, if that makes sense.
Totally. On page 68, we also have an example of something else you do, which I've not seen before. You have a lot of overlapping dialogue.
Yes.
But you also do this thing, you warn us in the title page thing that there's going to be. There's a slash in the first person's dialogue to show where the person is interrupting. And I've never seen that done before. And so tell me about your choice to do that.
Yeah. The slash, it's sort of don't make, and then there's a slash fun. And then Lori's I'm not. So the word that overlaps is fun and I'm. So don't make, I'm not. Like that's sort of the way it's supposed to sound. I took that from playwrights. I took it from Carol Churchill does it all the time in her plays. And Tony Kushner does it in his plays. And it's something that I find really useful because if you want to specifically hear certain words, but you like a controlled cacophony, it's very helpful because it makes the actors know it's not talking over each other. It's like a madrigal or a round or something.
It's also an anticipation of what they were going to say. And
exactly. Yeah. So, it gave for the girls in particular, like the four of them, it's overlapping all the time. And it gave a very technical thing to work on during rehearsal, which was wonderful, which was getting everyone up to speed. And it means I mean, I like this in general. I like words. I like everything said exactly how I wrote it. because I have strange rhythm things that if you change a word, it sounds wrong to me. And it makes it so that you need to have the lines memorized in a muscle memory. You can't be reaching for the lines ever. No. And I like that kind of memorization, and I like that kind of ability because it allows me to, especially with the group scenes, treat all the actors like an orchestra.
Yeah. You're also able to stay wide.
Yes.
Which is helpful.
Exactly. And I think some of that does come from my background as, my first love was theater. I wanted to write plays.
And plays are very much that. But here I want to talk about the other films you made and the whole genre of filmmaking you made, because I associate Mumblecore as being underscripted.
Well, it was. Yeah. You know, that's the funny thing is, I wanted to go be a playwright. But then I became involved with this very loose improvisational in all ways. We'd have like characters, we'd have scenes, ideas, but we would have no actual lines written out or just the most rudimentary lines written out because we would find it in improvisation on camera. And it was incredibly useful in a lot of ways because I mean, it's became a film school. It became the way I figured out how things were edited and what the camera's interested in and not interested in. But I always missed writing. I really always missed the written word, and I missed what actors could do with text. Yeah. Because I found that in a certain way, I think we're all understandably self-protective. And as actors improvising, I think it's actually very hard to go to scary places. Something will stop you from doing it. It doesn't want you, you know, your brain is protecting your ego or however that works. And one thing about text is it forces you to be vulnerable in a way that you might not be if you weren't given it. So like when I think of part of the job of an actor is to rise to the text, that you can have very complicated, very vulnerable things that you might not access another way. So I always missed the text. And so when I started writing with Noah Baumbach, and I wrote those two movies with him, part of it was because when I read, the first time I worked with him was as an actor. And when I read his screenplay for Greenberg, I thought, oh, this is, yes, it's so precise. It is so precise. I know exactly. I could hear it when I was reading it. And that was something that we really shared. So when we started writing together, that's how I wrote. And then as I continued writing, that's just how I continued writing. I mean, maybe one day I'll loosen up, but I really like things just said as they were written.
You talk about vulnerability. So I want to get to a second clip. So this is Joe and Marmy. They're talking in the attic. So it's page 100 of the screenplay.
Sure.
Probably comes from chapter 42 of the book.
Yep.
Let's take a listen.
I just feel like women, they have minds. And they have souls as well as just hearts. And they've got ambition and they've got talent as well as just beauty. And I'm so sick of people saying that love is just all a woman is fit for. I'm so sick of it. But I'm so lonely.
So that is a terrific speech, a terrific moment, so iconic. Let's talk about what it looks like on the page.
Sure.
So they've been having a conversation. It gets down to Joe. The parenthetical reads, crying, comma, trying to explain herself to herself. And then it gets into those words. What a great parenthetical.
Oh, yes. I do like a parenthetical. it's funny. I do think of screenplays as pieces of writing that should be able to stand on their own. And I try to make them as deep as possible. And I think I never want it to be just a blueprint. And I think one of my sadnesses actually about screenwriting is, unlike playwriting, is that the screenplay is just never a thing.
Yeah,
it's never
read.
No. And I have some pride in what the actual text of the screenplay is, including screen directions, including parentheticals. So in any case, thank you for pointing out the parenthetical that no one will know. But I also think sometimes I try to cue in the actor to something that is going on. But in any case, so this scene, it's come off of this sequence of death to marriage to I wanted to do this thing of like the older timeline where Beth lives, then all of a sudden it's Christmas. And then when you go back to she's gone, then it's the funeral. And then of course, like to me, it made perfect sense to go from a funeral to a wedding. It's like, these are the ceremonies of how we mark life. Like this is how we do it. This is what, anyway, so we do that. And then, but there's all these losses that have accumulated in both timelines. And this comes from the chapter where Joe does say,
I'm so lonely.
She actually doesn't technically say, I'm so lonely.
Marmy says, I see you're lonely.
I see. Yes. And Marmy says it. And then, but she does say, if he asked me now, I'd say yes, which I felt like, wait, we always think of Joe as being like so certain in her path. Like she never doubts it. I think that's kind of to the text of Joe. And I was like, she doubted it. She wondered, should I have done the other thing? Which I just, kills me. And, And in any case, this text, this speech, Women Have Minds and Souls as Well as Hearts, actually is from another book that Louisa May Alcott wrote. This is from Moods, I believe. I have to go back and double check that. But I think it's from Moods. And I found this piece of text. I thought it was so beautiful. But to me, but I'm so lonely just was kind of the penetrating thing in this chapter. I will say about this chapter too, which goes to the idea of the narrator, is that it begins with the narrator, which we can assume is Louisa May Alcott, speaking about being a spinster and speaking about never marrying. And she says, what she says is girls of 5 and 20 joke about being spinsters, but they do it because they don't really think it's going to happen. She was like, but when girls become 30, they stop talking about it at all because they know it's happening. And then she says, she goes on this kind of tangent of like, be kind to the spinsters because you don't know what passions are hidden under their somber gowns or something like that. It's like this amazing tangent. And I was like, oh my God, it's her talking. Like, you don't know what my life was or my loves were based on the fact that I didn't get married. Like, that's not, you cannot tell my heart from my outsides. And I just thought that that was such an incredible thing. And I, in any case, I wanted that to be part of the scene. And so when I found this passage, I was like, I love this passage. And I want to add this penetrating loneliness. And I also think there is something about not just Joe as a character, but I think there is a certain loneliness to the writer. And I think she has the loneliness of both.
At the end of the script,
yes,
we get to sections where they're labeled fiction, question mark. And so that's one of the lovely controversies of your movie is sort of like, what actually happens? And I'm not going to ask you to the state, because clearly looking at the script, you want it to be, there to be some ambiguity in terms of to what degree did she do this thing? Did she not do this thing? To what degree is she the author of this text? You start the movie with, the book by Louisa May Alcott and with a book by Joe March. So it's clearly, it's getting into that sense of like, what is authentic? What is authorship? Mm-hmm. But this choice of labeling fiction at the end.
Yes.
Was this controversial at all during the development?
Yes. Well, it was controversial also because someone said, oh, you've sent the wrong thing. There's question marks all over the end. This can't possibly be the final draft. And I was like, no, it is. I mean, this is the end of the book. The end of the book is she's opened the school. She's married Professor Bear and it's Marmy's birthday. That's the end of the book. So that is the end of the book. And in life, Louisa May Alcott, she didn't get married. She didn't have kids, but she did keep her copyright. And the book that was printed, which is actually the book that you see being made, is a reproduction of the first printing of 1868, which sold out in 2 weeks, which is kind of incredible. Crazy. I knew I wanted it to interweave. And I knew, this goes more towards directing. But to me, directing and writing, it's all so... linked, because to me, everything needs to be on the page in a way that I understand. And I didn't know exactly how I wanted to shoot this or how I wanted to shoot the scenes of the past or the fiction question mark. But, I did know I wanted the style to be different. And, it's a more heightened style, like, and I wanted it to feel that way. I wanted it to feel
steady cam shots.
Yes. And, well, actually we're on a crane. Nice. We're on a big, and someone's on a wheel, and we did these big long shots where we did three sequences. It's like, it took all day to go through the house and then to go on the other side of the house and then go down to Marmy. In any case, it was a big, I don't actually have a lot of, I have two moments of Steadicam in the movie, but everything else is on dollies or cranes. But in any case, like, I knew I wanted it to feel heightened. It's funny. I was actually just talking with, I hope I'm not like giving away trade secrets, but I think he's talked about this. Edgar Wright about the end of Baby Driver.
Yeah.
Which is, a fantasy. Sure. But he didn't, he was like, well, some people don't know that, but that's okay.
That's fine.
Like, that's okay. Like, whatever you want to know about it. But in any case, I hope I didn't give anything too much away about that. But I wanted it to be both. But what I did know is that I wanted the moment at the end when you see Jo hold her book. And I knew from the beginning I wanted it to be this way. I wanted to figure out how to do a trick where the image you didn't know you wanted to see was this girl holding her book.
Exactly. Well, you've established the goal of the character from the very start to have her book printed. And so if the movie ended with like Marmy's birthday, that's not rewarding.
No, it's not. No. Marmy's birthday is...
It's lovely, but it's not. Yeah, it's not the reason we're here.
But it is... But I felt like because I'm doing this thing where I'm honoring the book itself, I also really wanted to do the literal ending of the book, which is this birthday. Someone was like, oh, it's so weird that it's her birthday. Why do you need that? And I was like, because for the people who know how the book ends, this is how the book ends. Yeah.
Julia Turner had one extra question, which is related to this moment.
Okay.
She asked, why did you make the professor a smoke show?
Oh.
Why is he hot?
Well, I mean, for a couple of reasons. Number one, movies. It's movies. but really, I mean... I don't want to get too much into this because I hesitate to talk about male gaze, female gaze, because I think it can sometimes ascribe something gendered to something that doesn't have to be. Like, I don't want to say like, this is how women see the world and this is how men see the world, because I just think that that's too reductive. But I'm a female filmmaker. I want Professor Mare to be Louis Grell. I feel like, men have been putting glasses on hot women forever and telling us they're awkward. I can do whatever I want. I always saw the with Laurie and Professor Bear and with James Norton, who's also very beautiful. And, you know, I found Chris Cooper, Tracy Letts, like they're beautiful men in all, you know, and I thought, you know, the very first time we see Timothy Chalamet, I shot that 48 frames per second. I shot that to be slow because I wanted to shoot him like Bo Derek.
Yeah.
He's the object. He is the object. And I felt like no one really understood why I'd done that. And actually I felt like no one knew totally at the studio why I'd done that and thought it was kind of goofy and weird and maybe take it out. And then the first time I ever had a screening of the movie in Paramus, New Jersey, I heard every girl in the audience they did exactly what Amy did. And I was like, cause that's the way we feel about Timothy, and that's okay. And I felt like I wanted to make Professor Bear the same way. I am a female filmmaker, and this is in some ways, if you're making him, if you're allowed to author that the way that looks, maybe you get to author it this way. You know, I wanted to do that. Also, I just like Louis, but in any case, it was in a way my own commentary on what we've been told women are in movies.
Yeah. Two questions that people wrote in with. Yeah. They're not specifically about your movie, but I think you might have some answers for it. This one you kind of already answered, but I'll ask the question too. Jordan asks, I recently read the script for Parasite by Bong Joon-ho and was completely blown away by how the scenes lifted off the page and roped me in. To be clear, I haven't seen this movie yet, but the text was enough to draw me in and make me incredibly invested in the family.
Hmm.
I also read the script for Annie Hall, another movie I hadn't seen, but it felt like a chore to drudge through, despite many people saying it's one of the best movies of all time. I felt like if I was a reader at a studio and came across this on my desk, I would have passed on it. My question is, how important is it for a movie to be engaging on the page?
Mm-hmm.
Writer-directors don't necessarily need to paint the world as richly because they're the ones shooting it, but it seems strange to leave that detail on the page because you know you have it in your head.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying that you think that screenplay needs to be a real document to read and enjoy that you can really see and feel the movie?
Yes. I'm just going to go to the first... I want the sentences to be active and to draw you in. I want to feel part of something that's in motion from the beginning. And I'm very deliberate about this. So like,
do you want to read some of your first page?
So, you know, it has the sort of New York Publishing Office, 1868. Jo March, our heroine, hesitates. To me, I'm interested. What? She hesitates. Like it feels open.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like I've opened something, and you know, not everyone has my taste, but for me, to give something that feels perhaps unnecessary. You could just write, she's standing in a hallway. Like, there's no reason, but the hesitates. You're like, why? What's going on? You know, okay. So Joe March, our heroine, hesitates in the half light of a dim hallway. She exhales and prepares, her head bowed like a boxer about to go into the ring. She puts her hand on the doorknob, a pause, and then she opens it onto a disorderly room. Like, I want the words to draw the picture. And then even at the end, and I didn't know what I meant when I wrote this, but at the very last page, she's given the book, and I say, Joe turns it over in her hands, touching it like the holy object it is, her inchoate desire made manifest. Joe looks up and sees the future. Cut to black. I don't know what I meant by sees the future, but I also did.
Yeah, you knew what you meant.
And I knew what I meant I knew that Saoirse would be able to do that because she's a genius.
Yeah.
But I feel like, for me, I always want every piece of making a movie to be as excellent as it can be, because the truth is, I don't know if this is going to become a movie, because they're so unlikely, because they're so unwieldy and expensive and it takes so long. So for the moment, all I have is this script. So I want it to be as good and as emotional and as detailed and as specific and as honestly as dense as it can be, because this is all I have of the movie at this moment. I don't have the movie yet. So I want every piece of it to feel that way, because that's how I know it's I can will it into existence if I can feel it on the page.
Yes. You're going to be asking all of your department heads to do their very, very best work. And so you, as the writer, doing your very, very best work, it's got to be inspirational if they can see what you've done on the page.
And I also think, like, little details that are, on page 2, a parenthetical that I always liked. I mean, now I'm just complimenting myself, but I do think, nobody ever knows the parentheticals, but on page 2, it says, what compensation, he's saying, they're talking about the story she's selling him. He says, we pay 25 to 30 for things of this sort. We'll pay 20 for that. She says, you can have it, make the edits. But the parenthetical just says money over art. Mm-hmm. And to me, I was like, oh, no one will ever see it. but I sort of wish, I sort of wish that the screenplay that would get distributed would be the actual complete shooting script. Because I find it, you do take things out and change them. And this is very close to the shooting script. But at the same time, I find as a screenwriter, one thing that helped me tremendously was being an actor, because there were lots of things I auditioned for that I didn't get. But what I did get was to read the script. Yeah. And then I got to watch the movie. And then I was like, oh, I see. It went from this thing to that thing. And I feel like reading essentially a transcription of a movie after the fact isn't as useful as reading the screenplay, because then you can really see what happened. So I understand why later it's like, well, you don't need to have the scene in that wasn't in. But but for my movies, actually, I will say they cut really, really close to the actual screenplays. And also my line producer said to me, he's like, you really did use all of it. And I was like, I told you I would. That's why I needed it.
Next movie, they'll know.
Exactly.
So on this podcast a lot, we've been talking about assistant pay and how low assistant pay is a pervasive problem in Hollywood. There's a New York Times story that came out today as we were recording this. You can see a photo of me and producer Meghna Rao in this exact room where we are recording this. Mm-hmm. But Kimberly wrote in with a question. She said, I'd love your thoughts on assistants with or wanting to start families. I'm really hoping to start a family within the next year, and I have 100% confidence in my ability to get both my assistant work and my own work done while also having a baby. But I'm afraid to ask for any maternity leave or an increase in pay to do so. Do I have any right as assistant to get pregnant and start a family? If this becomes an issue with my higher ups, do I have the right to call foul for women's rights? Will this cost me my job, which I like and want to keep entirely? I recognize this is an issue that is countrywide and spreads across multiple industries, but I'm hoping you can talk more about specifically assistants who aren't in their young 20s, who may have families or added responsibilities, especially women, and how they can navigate moving up in this crazy industry.
Yeah, well, this is a big one.
Yeah.
This is the big, I think this is a huge part of talking about women, both in our industry, in all industries, and what we're doing about it as a country and collectively. And I think it's something that, I mean, I don't want to speak to things that I don't have actual the correct knowledge to speak to, but I do think that there is something about things that are quote unquote women's issues or family issues where somehow they become something that you just have to deal with behind closed doors and we have no idea how you got from A to B. And I think that's a failure of our sense of what civic life is. And I think civic life is family life. How do you think we get engaged citizens? By people raising them, mothers and fathers. And I think you can point to a lot of Scandinavian countries who have very excellent ways of dealing with this. And actually something I was, when I was in Sweden, they told me they have not just maternal leave, but they have paternal leave, which is mandatory.
Absolutely. Norway has it as well.
Because otherwise they want to make sure that men don't not take the time.
Or that women are penalized for having taken the time and men are moving up.
And men are moving up. So I mean, I think that this is at the center of a civic discussion is what are we doing for families? And it's everything. It's healthcare, it's benefits, it's leave. And, you know, I will say, because I was pregnant while I was making Little Women and I gave birth 72 hours after I showed the studio my cut. And it's something I'm still educating myself about and learning about because, I did not know a lot of the laws that were already on the books. And I'm not someone who is, doesn't have access to information, but I actually didn't know that you have there in California that you have to, the employers are required to have a certain amount of paid leave. And I didn't know any of that. I didn't know stuff like that. And I also think, you know, what are the laws that are on the books? What are the laws that we need to get on the books? What do we need to move forward? Also, I mean, childcare. I mean, national childcare. I mean, I have help, and I also have my mother and my dad watching my baby while I'm able to do different things, and
record
then I also
podcast.
Record this podcast, and I also have an amazing nanny, and that is something I am able to have because I have access and I have means, and not everyone has that, and it's. I mean, this is a big old thing. So I guess everything I'm saying is just to say, I don't know, but that's the right question. And I think I and everyone else, I do want to figure it out. I think also as filmmakers, it's difficult because if you're employed by a corporation, there's laws that you can, I don't know that this is completely right, but there can be laws that constrain and also prescribe corporations to do X, Y, or Z. So if you are an assistant working for a company, there's, or employed through a company, there's something that sort of can be done in a top-down way. But if you're a writer or if you're a director, if it's a gig economy in a different way, then it's like, you know, you're writing something on spec. There is no one to give you leave. You're on leave because you're not working. Do you know what I mean? So that's I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. Same with acting. Like it's not.
Totally.
You know, so, and I don't know if it's something that we need to go guild by guild or it's a national thing we need to be dealing with or industry, but it is. Here's another thing I'll say in addition to being in Sweden. When I was in, I shot a film in Paris. There's this at French Hours.
Oh, French Hours are required. I mean,
French Hours are also the women who are working on the set and the men who are working on the set, because of the day is more manageable, they were able to either take their kids to school in the morning or give them dinner and put them to bed. But if you're working 12 hours and then with transpo and everything, it's 14 hours away from your family. If you're a man or a woman, when are you going to take care of your family?
Craig and I are both pushing for French Hours.
I think it's so much more human.
Yeah.
And so that's a whole lot of like gobbledygook I just spat out. But I
share
I
your frustration. And in Kimberly's question, when she said, do I have any right as an assistant to get pregnant and start a family?
Yes.
I wanted to throw a chair because I mean, yes, you do.
And
part of like having, you know, reproductive rights is like the right to become pregnant.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And of course, and also there should be laws to protect that and resources to help you.
Yes.
I mean, yes. There's a book I read. It sounds, the title of it is, it sounds much more hard than it is, but it's called Motherhood and Cruelty. but it's by a really interesting thinker, Jacqueline Rose, I think is her name. Anyway, she says, it's funny that parenthood is seen as an antisocial act, because what could be more social? That it's something that, like, meaning, as we were speaking about civic responsibilities, or but sort of like a thing you do on your own.
Yeah.
But yet, what is more social than parenthood?
Parenthood, like, and continuing our culture and our species and you know, that our civilization.
That is a social act, but it's seen as like, that's you do on your own time. And that the social thing is seen as just capitalism or commerce. And somehow that's not part of it. But anyway, yes, of course, it's of course you have the right.
At the end of every episode, we talk about one cool things. My one cool thing this week is actually a puzzle which is sitting in front of you. It's called New York in Color. It is this really good 500-piece puzzle we did over Christmas holidays. It's these photos by Nicole Robertson. I just loved it. I love a jigsaw
that's
puzzle.
So cool.
I find it like a great way to sort of make my brain stop braining and just like sort of focus on puzzle pieces. So like especially good for like the last thing at night before you go to bed, just check out.
Puzzling. You know who's a big puzzler is genius actress I've gotten to work with is Laurie Metcalf.
Oh, I can imagine.
Loves a puzzle. Right. She also puzzles before she goes on stage every night on Broadway. She'll like get there an hour early. She'll puzzle for a while and then she'll go out and give like the best performance you've ever seen in anything. And then she kind of, I don't know. She's extraordinary. I love her. That's good. Well, I guess I'll give a book suggestion.
We love books.
It's a big book, but it's a rewarding book. Is Behave by Robert Sapolsky. I don't want to get the title wrong, but he's a professor at Stanford. He's a evolutionary biologist, I think. But he's written a lot about he studies primate behavior. Right. And anyway, he's written a lot of really fun. I love science books for lay people.
Yep, like, as do I.
Because like, I don't really have the math to do it. Yeah. Like I can't do any of the real stuff, but like, I am so happy to have it explained to me in sort of layman terms. And I loved it. And it's chock full of lots of interesting things, but it's sort of about like a given behavior that we say like, why this? And then he's like, and he sort of walks it through kind of from the nearest proximity to the farthest away. So like milliseconds before a behavior happens, you know, what are the synapses in your brain doing? Like, how does it get from there to here? But then like, if you walk it back 2 weeks, where are your hormonal levels? And then if you walk it back, you know, 100 million years, how did we get to this point of this behavior? It's a very interesting book. And also I think, one thing is because I read a lot of fiction, but, it's not a book that I inherently thought, oh yes, I need to know all about this. But I think as a writer, it's important to read widely.
Oh, absolutely. And this sounds like a book that, you know, an actor, director, or writer, like talk about behavior.
It's
like,
just interesting.
What is the motivation that got that moment to happen?
And it's looking at from a very specific perspective, but it's really, yeah. And I also think, somebody told me when I was young, it was actually a neighbor said, if you read widely, consistently, that's as good as going to college. And I said, really? And then she said, yeah, just keep reading everything and don't only look at the one thing you're interested in. And, I mean, I ended up going to college, but, I don't know. I never forgot that she said that.
Yeah. I think that's probably true.
Yeah.
That is our show for this week.
Oh.
So for listeners who are premium members, stick around afterwards because Craig will talk about what happened at the Golden Globes.
Okay.
Script Notes is produced by Megan Arau. It's edited by Matthew Shelley. Our outro is by Gemma Moran. If you have an outro, you can send us a link to ask@johnaugust.com. That's also the place where you can send longer questions. For short questions on Twitter, Craig is @CLMazin. I am @JohnAugust. You are not on Twitter, I've noticed.
No, I'm not on any
You're
of
so
those things.
Smart. No. So smart. You can find the show notes for this episode and all episodes at johnaugust.com. We'll have links to the books she mentioned, and we'll also have a link to the screenplay so you can download it and read it. That'll also be up in Weekend Read if you want to read it there. You'll find transcripts at johnaugust.com. We get them up about 4 days after the episode airs. And of course, you can become a premium member at scriptnotes.net, where you get all the back episodes and bonus segments. Greta Gerwig, thank you so much for being on the show. Please come back anytime.
Thank you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Craig Mason, welcome back to Script Notes.
Oh, thank you, John. A little under the weather. Sorry I couldn't be there. I was so bummed, but you did not want me there. That's for sure.
So when I was talking with Greta, you thought you had a cold, but that was not, in fact, the case.
No. So I thought I'm feeling worse than I would normally feel with a cold. And I had a night of, you know, those dreams, those looping dreams where you just dream about like the same 4 seconds of dream over and over and over. So
yeah, it's a fever thing. Yeah,
that's a fever thing. So, I went to work, I sat there, I did absolutely nothing except just feel awful. And on the way home, I swung by the urgent care clinic here in my little town and they did a test for the flu. Have you ever had the flu test?
No, but is it a nasal swab? How do they do it?
Yeah, it's a nasal swab. They put a little Q-tip up both nostrils, but man, they go in deep. It is incredibly unpleasant. Anyway, they go and they do this fast test and the doctor came back in and she said, well, you know, let's just cut to the chase. You've got the flu, which is bad. And I'm stupid. I didn't get the flu shot. Because I was, it's not because I love the flu shot. I worship the flu shot. I just, you know, oh, I was too busy. Blah. Well,
that's what happens.
And people are nice. They're trying to come for me by saying, I got the flu shot and I also got the flu, which can happen. But they put me on Tamiflu immediately. And it's been very effective, I will say.
Good.
Yeah. I think if you have a choice between getting a cold or getting the flu and having Tamiflu started immediately, weirdly, you're better off with the flu and Tamiflu.
All right. So you're on the mend. Now, the reason why I desperately wanted you on for this bonus segment is you and I have not spoken since you won your Golden Globe. And most crucially, since that moment where you were up on stage, so Jared Harrod is speaking, he's giving a speech, but you're holding the Golden Globe.
Yeah.
And Tiffany Haddish leans her weight against you. And there's an eye contact moment. What was happening between you and Tiffany Haddish on stage at the Golden Globes?
You know, some people thought that maybe she was going to faint or something, but I think all she was doing was taking her shoes off. I think she was uncomfortable in her shoes.
Okay.
And when I look at the shoes that people wear, I get it. I understand why. So we were just kind of, so I was like, oh, this is cool. Me and Tiffany Haddish. I'm not going to tell you what we talked about. We had a good conversation. It's private. It's private stuff between me and the
100%.
Tiff. 100%.
Yeah. Yeah, I get it.
But, well, I'll tell you off the air. Okay. I was so happy to not, so I had arranged to not do the speech. Some people were wondering why I did not do the speech. And the answer is, you know, we all worked on this. And when it comes to an award where the show is winning, I think it's fair for some of the other people that worked so hard on it to talk. We initially, I convinced Jane Featherstone to do it, but we all expected Jared to win.
Yeah.
And he didn't. In fact, the opposite of what I thought would happen. I thought Jared would win and I thought the show and Stellan and Emily would lose, and Jared did not win and the show and Stellan won. And I said to Jane, what do you think about, you know, the speech? And she said, yeah, let's give Jared the speech. I mean, he was our quarterback, and so he did a great job. I mean, he was a little nervous that he had to have a rejiggered speech up there. But
we also had to follow Michelle Williams, which felt like just, I mean, a bullet dodge on your behalf, because she gave, you know, really the moment of the evening. And the next speech after that was not going to be as big a moment.
Well, I think when you're watching television, that's probably how it feels. In the room itself, there were a lot of good speeches, I thought. I mean, hers was terrific. Maybe my favorite was Rami right off the bat.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he was adorable. I was like, this guy is so humble and not fake humble, 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 and genuine. and funny. I thought that was fantastic. And I could have listened to Tom Hanks, who I think gave me the flu from the stage. I didn't meet him. I didn't get to meet him. I was so bummed out. But I think just by listening to him intently, I got his flu. But I could have listened to him for another hour. I just was fascinated by him. You know, the truth is, honestly, speeches.
Now, the reputation of the Golden Globes and everything I've heard is it's a very boozy evening.
Yeah.
Was that your experience there in that room?
Oh, yeah. So it is. There's two large ice buckets on your table, each with a magnum of champagne in it. I think that's what that's called, that big bottle. And they have wine coming around all night long and people are getting drunk. There's no question about that. It's a very strange kind of dinner. We got there on the early side, and because it's, the red carpet had no interest in me and feelings mutual. I'm not wearing like some flowing gown, nor am I an actor. So Melissa and I just headed on into the ballroom, I guess you'd call it. And there were, you know, maybe like it was 20% full. And every single seat at every single table there was a bowl of soup. And after about 8 or 9 minutes of being in there, and maybe 5 or 6 other people had come in, an army of waiters just swept through and removed the soup. And I just thought, no one's ever going to have the soup.
Nope. Soup is gone.
The soup is gone. And then, yeah, it's a very...
Maybe that's a lesson for life. Like, the soup will always disappear. So if you don't take advantage of the soup when you can have the soup, there's no soup to be had.
I just thought, like... But I get it, because what they don't want is people eating during the show.
Yeah.
But if you don't want people eating during the show, and you do want people on the red carpet, then you should just not have food. But then I think some people will get grumpy and drunker. I was just fascinated by the whole thing. The tables are so close together. Everyone's very chummy. I mean, it is tight.
And Cousin Greg was joining you at your table for at least part of the evening.
Oh, my God. Well, we were so happy. So Nicholas Braun, who plays Cousin Greg on Succession, aside from being one of the tallest people in the world, is also one of the most pleasant. He's just a sweetheart. And there were just a lot of Succession people, and he kind of got like overflowed onto our table. And I kept telling him, I'm like, first of all, I spent most of the night just yelling the word Succession out because I love that show so much. And Jesse Armstrong is so brilliant and the cast is so great. And they seem like a happy family. They legitimately do seem like they like each other, which is always nice, especially when it's a show about people that hate each other or rivals. And I said to Nicholas, if we win, you should come up there with us. Just come up. Let's not explain it. Let's not make it seem weird. You just happen to join us as if you were on the show.
Yes, the way Greg was always showing up with the Roy's places. Like, why is Cousin Greg there?
Right. And he said, should I? And there was an HBO executive at the table who said, no, you should not. She said, you know, Chernobyl's over. Your show is continuing. No. But we almost had him. We almost got him.
Congratulations on the Golden Globe. You are skipping out on is it TCAs tonight? What do you
know?
What was the awards tonight?
Tonight is, as we're recording this, it's the Critics' Choice, and I'm very sorry.
That's right.
I can't be there, but Carolyn Strauss and Jared Harris are there, and hopefully we do well. But you know, listen, I never thought I would be on any Critics' Choice shortlist. So it's very nice, and I'm sorry I won't be there, but I think everybody would prefer that I not bring my contagious self.
Absolutely. Well, congratulations on that. I hope you do get a chance to hang out with Greta Gerwig in the future because you would love her. We talked about Parentheticals and a lot of stuff on the page. She will be one of your favorite writers, I suspect. But Craig, continue to heal up and we'll have a normal show next week, hopefully.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it.
All right.
Bye.